Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This week's episode of Harry Potter and the Sacred Text is brought to you by Prose. Casper, I just got a wonderful, wonderful haircut.
It looks so good.
Thank you. I feel great with it, but I cut off over a foot of hair, and that means my long hair was sort of pulling my curls in one way, and now that I have short hair, I need a totally different hair care routine. Luckily, Prose is made for people, not hair and skin types. Personalization is rooted in everything they do, from their in-depth consultation to their made-to-order model. And so I used the review and refine feature, and I was like, yes, I still want vegan hair care products. Yes, I still want to smell like a lavender field, but my hair is no longer long. It is short to medium length. Please send me a different formula of shampoo and conditioner.
Prose is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at prose.com/Harry Potter. So you get your free consultation and then 50% off at prose.com/Harry Potter. That's prose.com/Harry Potter.
Chapter 15, The Hogwarts High Inquisitor. They had expected to have to comb Hermione's Daily Prophet carefully next morning to find the article Percy had mentioned in his letter. However, the departing delivery owl had barely cleared the top of the milk jug when Hermione let out a huge gasp and flattened the newspaper to reveal a large photograph of Dolores Umbridge. I'm Matt Potts.
And I'm Vanessa Zoltan.
And this is Harry Potter and the Sacred Text.
Matt, for today's Patreon perk, I'm just going to tell a story. Something happened to me yesterday that was very shocking. I caught a minister talking badly about me behind my back. This is eventually going to be a Harry Potter and the Sacred Text opening story, but we have a rule to preach from our scars and not our wounds, and so it will not be in an episode for a little while. So I am just going to tell the unfiltered wound version of this story on today's Every Flavored Bean conversation. You've already heard this story.
I'm excited about this. I've heard this story, and I'm excited to hear it again, hear it told to our listeners. There's a lot of unnecessary antagonism in this chapter.
Yes.
And yeah, it's completely consistent with your experience yesterday.
Thank you. Okay, I'm very excited to tell the unvarnished version of this story to our listeners. And you can listen to that if you go to patreon.com/Harry Potter Sacred Text.
Also, remember to review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe there for ad-free episodes. Vanessa, you're going to tell us a story about charisma.
I am. So, Matt, I'm actually going to tell a classroom story. We spent a lot of time in the classroom in this chapter. And one of the moments of my life where I, like, truly encountered charisma was in the classroom at Harvard Divinity School. I was taking a class called On Death and Dying, and it was about spiritual care for people who were grieving a loved one or grieving that they had been given some sort of terminal diagnosis. And it was co-taught by a minister and a professor. And the minister who was teaching, I think, is someone who you probably know, Dorothy Austin. And Dorothy, Matt, I think you would agree with me, was an incredibly charismatic teacher and minister. Like, when you were in her presence in the classroom, she's, like, quiet and reserved, but, like, only says wise things. And I think the thing that was most charismatic about her in the classroom was what an incredible listener she was. And so there was something about her that you just felt like she is listening to every word that I have to say, and she cares so deeply about me. So in our very first class, she had us all go around and introduce ourselves. And this is like a pretty perfunctory thing that I always find annoying in class, to be honest. I'm like, you're not going to remember this. Like, why are we doing this? And it is rarely well done. It is sometimes well done, but it is rarely well done, in my opinion. And Dorothy, you know, had us go around. And what it felt like was that in meeting each of us, she was like giving us a blessing, right? She was like, yes, Matthew, like, tell me, why did you come to divinity school, right? Like, it was like this short interview. It felt so special. And I walked out of the classroom and I remember thinking, I think that she and I had an extra special connection. Like, everyone feels that way, but I feel like she and I really had that. And then I was like, wow, that is like an ugly feeling. Like, why can't this woman be special and just make everybody feel good? And that to me is one of the things about charisma. It can sometimes make me feel uneasy. I can second guess the genuineness of it, or I can like feel like it's scarce and want more of it. Or I'm like, well, everybody sees that this person is special, right? This is what I think of as like the drummer crush syndrome. Like, everyone has a crush on the lead singer, so I'm gonna have a crush on the drummer, right? Like, there's something about truly charismatic people that, at least for me, can sometimes make me feel insecure. And I'm wondering about that with charisma, because I know that I'm a petty person, and yet I do find that sometimes charisma can make us curious about whether or not we're being manipulated, right? We often think of like con artists as having a lot of charisma. I'm just interested in this thing that seems pure, which is like the ability to charm, as potentially complicated. Dorothy Austin is not complicated in her charisma. I had a complicated reaction to something very genuine in her.
That's so interesting, because you're like, how dare a person make me and others feel special?
Yes, equally like, special.
That's right. How dare a person recognize the innate goodness and beauty of each individual person? There should be a ranking.
It just felt like a participation award. I was like, well, I'm not special. You make everyone feel special.
I like your story, not because of what it tells us about charisma, but because of what it tells us about you.
I talked myself down from it.
No, I know.
I was like, okay. Wow, that is so special that she can do that for everyone.
The etymology of charisma is really fascinating. I don't know if you remember, but way back in the day, we did an episode where the theme was charm.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually thought that the root of charm was going to be linked to the root of charisma, and it's not. Charm comes from like song making or something like that. It has to do with magic. But charisma is the Greek word for grace.
Oh my God.
And it kind of captures all the elements of grace, not only like elegance and beauty, but also the idea of given freely and giftedness.
Yeah.
So like the English word gratitude comes from charisma.
Wow.
Like anything that's given freely to a person, not because they deserve it, but just because they are, like that comes from charisma. And it's different than charm, right? Charm is a little bit of a trick, right? But you can see how, like, even in the way we use charisma and in your reaction to Dorothy Austin's charisma, how that can be manipulated. If you can convince someone that you have charisma when you actually don't, that they are special even though you don't think they are, like, that's charm, right? That can be manipulative. I mean, the danger or the risk or the suspicion you have is earned, I guess. Is that the right verb? Like, we know that charisma is used this way, manipulated this way in human relations. But when we dig down to the Greek, there is something more pure in it, or at least more laudable.
Yeah. And I do think the way that we use it is very different now, right? Like when we talk about charismatic religion and, right, like, but that root, I really want to explore that root and say that it does turn out that I am correct. Dorothy Austin was one of the most charismatic teachers I've ever had. So gracious. Yeah. Thinks everyone is a blessing.
Like if you want to say thank you in Greek, you say, Echaristo. You put the grace in there. Yeah.
Wow. Well, Matt, everybody is about to be blessed with your unmitigated grace and charisma with
the free gift
recap.
Of a 30-second recap.
The free gift that you are just giving from the goodness of your heart. And interestingly enough, you will also do it with great charm, which has nothing to do with charisma.
No, nothing to do with charisma.
But you're going
to
do both.
Yeah.
Okay. On your mark. Get set. Go.
So the owls come in and they drop a daily prophet, and lo and behold, Umbridge is the High Inquisitor. What the heck does that mean? And also, it was never Dumbledore's choice to put her in here. And she's visiting classrooms, and she goes to Trelawney's, and she's like, Trelawney, are you actually a seer? And Trelawney's like, yes, I see bad things about you. And she's like, maybe you don't. And then they go to Grubbly Plank, and Grubbly Plank's like, Dumbledore is the best. And also, I don't know anything about Hagrid, and I'm pretty happy with the way things are around here. And then they go to McGonagall, and McGonagall's like, why are you here? I'm not paying attention to you. And then Hermione's like, this is never going to get better. We need to start. You need to train us, Harry.
That was so
good. And then
good.
Harry gets really mad. I know. I missed the fight at the end. But you can cover that in your...
Yeah. Well, I think you didn't have time for two things. And so I'll do those two things.
Okay, great. Oh, I can only remember one thing I missed.
Yeah, don't worry. I'll remind you.
Okay, great. Okay. I'll count you in.
Please do.
3, 2, 1, go.
So Hermione is raising her hand in Umbridge's class. And Umbridge is like... what do you want? And Hermione's like, I've already read the whole book. And Harry gets really mad again, and he loses his temper with Umbridge again. And so he is going to get more detention. And Angelina's mad at him, and McGonagall is so mad at him for losing his temper that she takes points away for getting a detention, which he thinks is not fair. He goes to detention. He has to write on his hand again. It's really bad. Hermione makes a healing potion, and then they get into a fight because she's like, you should run Dumbledore's army. And he's like, I'm not that smart. That's not what he says.
That was great. I forgot a lot of things, and you covered them all, and that was great. And I feel like I've come into a different relationship with the 30-second recap. I realize now that however little I remember of the chapter, I can probably fill 30 seconds. So,
so Matt, I think we should start with charisma with the Hogwarts High Inquisitor. So she is the chief question asker of Hogwarts. Is that what this position is? I don't know what a High Inquisitor is.
I guess so. I mean, to me, it's harkening back to evil positions of Inquisition. Like, right? Like,
sure, right.
It's obviously like, this is a bad thing.
Right.
Meant to
You're
be
like
a good thing,
picturing the right. Doge's palace in Venice in the 15th
exactly.
century.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. And yet you're going to say that she has great charisma.
No. I am going to make an argument that I think Umbridge is without charisma in this chapter. Mm. I think that she is like eschewing all efforts at charisma and is just throwing around power and is just throwing around the authority that she has been given by Fudge, whether or not that authority is sort of respected within this school. And the moment that I want to look in on is one of these moments where she is doing a teacher evaluation. So that's one of the things that she's going to do is the High Inquisitor. I actually think that this is good. I think some of the pedagogy at Hogwarts needs improvement. And so if there was like
really?
A teaching coach who was going around to the classrooms and giving like helpful feedback after like teacher observations, I would be all for it. That is not what's happening. What's happening here is like a punitive attempt to like, you know, it is a punitive kind of witch hunt. No pun intended. But her first visit that we see is of Professor Trelawney. And the text tells us that Umbridge puts her chair inches behind Trelawney. Inches. That is a creepy invasion of personal space. And, right, like, that is not charismatic. That is not grace. That is not openness. That is not charming. That is just, like, I have such a right in this classroom, I don't even have to respect personal boundaries anymore. Someone who was attempting at charisma would at least pretend that they were up to more than one thing in this classroom other than throwing their power around and being punitive.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think Umbridge's character really gets to this distinction that was emerging in your story between something like charm and something like charisma. Because we do know that Umbridge seems to put a lot of energy into an outward appearance of like propriety and also like daintiness and gentleness. Like it seems like that she puts a lot of energy into performing something like this. And one would think that she does that to sort of charm people into thinking that's how she actually is. But we know just from detention and other things that she is willing to exercise power in really cruel ways, right? And actually is neither gentle nor dainty or whatever other adjectives are appropriate, right? Like there's something going on there. But I also think that, like, you know, there's a way in which power is charismatic, or at least power charms people. Mm. Again, we're getting to this really messy distinction between charm and charisma. Because I know that's not in this chapter, but in the last chapter, they get this letter from Percy. And remember, Percy says that Umbridge is such a delightful woman, right? Yeah. And I can't tell if Percy actually finds her outward performed gentleness, propriety delightful, or if Percy finds power delightful. Because I think I think Percy finds power delightful, because that's why he's in the ministry. That's why he won't, right? So he might realize, or maybe not be willing to admit to himself, that she is as cruel and willing to wield power as she is, but he finds that kind of just attractive. Or maybe he doesn't see any of that stuff. He just sees her, like, the outward kind of performance she's putting on, and sees that. I'm not sure which it is, but in either case, like, she has some charisma and or charm with respect to Percy. Do you think that's right, or what do you think?
Yeah, I do think power can be charismatic. At least when I think about charisma versus charm, charm is like delightful, right? But I can pull my focus from charm. Whereas charisma, it is like a spell. Like, you can't, and like, maybe I'm making a false distinction or only one that lives in my head. But like, I can find like, right, like two dogs playing, charming, right? Like, that is very charming. That is delightful. I am like bewitched by the cuteness of it. But charisma feels like a vortex that you are pulled into, almost as something with a gravitational pull. Like, I can't resist it.
Yeah. And this is maybe, again, pointing to another interesting facet of your story, which is, you know, one of the things you said was that Dorothy Austin had this towards everyone. I think one of the things that we think about charisma is that it's kind of universal, like everyone's drawn to it.
You just have
one of the things I was thinking, is like, oh, maybe charisma's in the eye of the beholder because Percy sees it, but other people don't. And maybe this is a way to distinguish charisma and charm, because charm is usually something you direct at a person because you're trying to, not always, you know, with malign intention, but trying to like get something out of them. Even if what you're trying to get out of them is for them to feel happy, right? Just for their own sake, right? Charm doesn't have to be manipulative, but like, you charm an individual, whereas charisma is something you have that everyone perceives. But I wonder if that's true. Like, you know, I'm there are probably people you find charismatic that I don't find charismatic, and there are probably of people course. I find charismatic that you don't. So maybe charisma's not as universal as we experience to be. But maybe, again, like, one of the distinctions, at least for us who are experiencing another's charisma or another's charm, is when someone's charming us, we know it's just for us. Mm-hmm. But when we experience someone else's charisma, we feel like, how could anyone not see this? Like, any person would feel the way I am feeling right now because this person is so irresistibly delightful in universal ways, right?
And I think that that is evidenced in idioms, right? Like, oh my God, I was so charmed by him. Versus you say, like, this person is charismatic, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. That's right. And to that, in that sense, like, Umbridge does not have charisma, right? Like, she seems to have charmed some folks, either by her power or by her, you know, the way she behaves or the way she speaks. But she, I don't think anyone has the sense that she has a universal appeal, except maybe Percy, but Percy's so hard to read. Who knows?
Percy's still learning.
He's still confused. Learning. Yeah, he's confused.
Whereas McGonagall, I would argue hardcore, this lady, especially in this chapter, is charisma on a stick. And it gives me a little bit of a theory on charisma that is just pulling together things that you and I have been talking about for years now. I think charisma is often about a right-sized confidence, right? Like, Dorothy Austin was just like confident that she could go around the classroom and that this was going to be an appropriate use of time. She was skilled in her teaching. She knows how to open, right? Like, there was just this assuredness that this was a worthwhile way to spend an opening class. Whereas I do think other teachers just don't know what to do with an opening class. Are like, we went through the syllabus, we're starting next time. I don't know. Tell us your names. So McGonagall, like Dorothy Austin, like, there's just this, like, I know what we're doing today. And like, it is in everything she does, right? She has a box of mice and she like hands it to Lavender, and Lavender is scared. And she's like, mice aren't scary. Like, I have been doing this for 39 years. A mouse has never bit a student. You are squeamish and like, actually, this is safe, right? Like, she has done this over and over again, and she knows she's a good teacher. She knows she gets the OWL results. She knows that she can, like, give every kid the appropriate education so that every single kid can pass. And, like, Umbridge can be there or not. She just doesn't care. And the kids are rapt by her. And if she was swaggering, right? If she was like, I'm about to show you something amazing, right? Like, we'd be like, okay, lady. But there's something about the right-sizedness of her confidence that I think creates a sense of security in the kids, right? Like, there's going to be, like, a kind of respectful order in this class. And also, because you trust, you can just sort of hand yourself over to someone, which I think is part of charisma, right? That gravity of handing yourself to someone.
Yeah. I mean, I think all of that's right. I think I'm going to approach it from a slightly different way, but I think I want to confirm everything that you say. I think that she has that confidence and it's right sized, and that does build trust with the students. I'm so glad we talked about Umbridge first, because having spoken about Umbridge and sorted out Umbridge's charisma slash charm slash lack thereof, it occurs to me that like McGonagall is like bizarro Umbridge. She's like the inverse of Umbridge. Like, she is completely unconcerned with charming anybody.
Yeah.
Like, she is not trying to get on the good side of Umbridge, even though Umbridge is there to evaluate her, whatever that means.
Right.
She's willing to take 5 points from her own house and from Harry. Like, you know, she's not trying to curry favor with anyone, but that makes her utterly fair and utterly reliable in a way that all the students recognize. And because they recognize how fair she is, how the fact that a Ministry High Inquisitor is there is not going to sway her or change the way she, like, they know they can rely on her.
Yeah.
And that is her charisma. That's what gives her presence and command and authority in that classroom, and why she can say to a child, don't be squeamish about the mouse.
Right.
And the child, like, knows it's true.
Right.
Because she is so uninterested in charming anybody and so absolutely interested in treating everyone fairly. Like,
yeah.
That has its own charisma, but she's not flouncing around the room trying to delight people, right? But she's just has built this sure trust, which comes from confidence. She knows what she's doing there. She knows what she can do and what she can't do, and, you know, what she can do for these children and how to care for them and teach them. And the children can just sense that. They know there's an adult in the room when McGonagall is there, which is exactly what they want a lot of the time. And so they find that's her charisma. That's her gift to them. So yeah, I absolutely see that. And it's integrated and related to everything you were saying about her confidence. But something about the kind of the foil of Umbridge, the kind of direct inverse of Umbridge's personality, it's almost like in book 5 or whatever, J.K. Rowling decided, I wonder what would happen if I wrote the opposite of McGonagall.
Right.
What would that person look like? And it would look a lot like Umbridge, I think.
Yeah.
Right?
No, I love that theory. McGonagall gives away her smiles very sparingly, whereas Umbridge is always smiling, but, like, you know, there's, like, malice behind it.
And although McGonagall never gives out smiles, it's the absolute opposite. There's always good intention behind it.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Like, Harry suspects that she maybe smiled at him at the end of class. And he's like, yes. Like, it means so much.
That's right. But he never doubts that she has his best interest and other students' best interest at heart.
Absolutely. Right? Even when he disagrees with her. I'm just wondering, Matt, if, like, something universal about charisma is that we all find highly competent people charismatic. Right? Like, part of why we love shows like The West Wing is because you're just, like, watching people be good at their jobs, right? Like, we love watching people be excellent at things. It's from ballet to a conductor, even if you don't understand, like, what it is that they're excellent at, right? Like, I don't really know what Steve Jobs did, and he's, like, was not a charming person, but he was excellent, and so we, like, couldn't keep our eyes off of him. And I'm wondering what you think about that, that just, like, true competence is almost universally charismatic, as close to universally charismatic as we get.
Yeah, and I think there's the right-sizedness of it that you were talking about. Like, the competence, which is just sort of like, I'm doing my job.
Right.
Like, really, really well. Right? And not trying to save the world with my job. I'm just doing my job really well. There's a movie, you know, the movie Spotlight about the Boston Globe investigative reporting team that uncovered the Catholic Church's sex abuse scandal here in the Archdiocese of Boston. And that movie is basically just like 2 hours of watching people do research and follow up.
Yeah, it's watching people be good at their jobs. That's it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, it's captivating. Just watching people like study and make phone calls and do things which are not super like fabulous or
comparing spreadsheets. They're like, exactly. He's on this list, but not on this list.
Yeah, and you can't take your eyes off of it, right?
No.
Because it's like it's both dedication and competence, right? It's both things together. But I think that's right.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This week's episode of Harry Potter and the Sacred Text is brought to you by Prose. Casper, I just got a wonderful, wonderful haircut.
It looks so good.
Thank you. I feel great with it, but I cut off over a foot of hair, and that means my long hair was sort of pulling my curls in one way, and now that I have short hair, I need a totally different hair care routine.
Mm.
Luckily, Prose is made for people, not hair and skin types. Personalization is rooted in everything they do, from their in-depth consultation to their made-to-order model. And so I used the review and refine feature, and I was like, yes, I still want vegan hair care products. Yes, I still want to smell like a lavender field, but my hair is no longer long. It is short to medium length. Please send me a different formula of shampoo and conditioner.
Prose is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at prose.com/Harry Potter. So you get your free consultation and then 50% off at prose.com/Harry Potter. That's prose.com/Harry Potter.
I mean, speaking of competence, let's talk about another character from this chapter and maybe expand our definition or look at one of the other definitions of charisma. I'd spoken about how charisma comes from this Greek word that means gift or can mean gift or grace or something. And I wonder, you know, at the end of this chapter, Hermione and Ron are trying to convince Harry that he should be their underground defense against the dark arts teacher. They know they're not going to get the instruction they need from Umbridge. They know that they are going to need some instruction because of their involvement with the Order of the Phoenix. Over the past summer, they know that a threat is rising and they feel they need to be prepared, and they're not wrong, right? And so they need some help. And since they don't have a trained teacher, they need someone who's just extraordinarily gifted, and it's Harry. Now, this leads to a big argument that I forgot to mention in my 30-second recap, and Harry does not like having this gift assigned to him. And I think it's because, you know, we can talk about this. It's a gift that has been revealed in like the most terrible experiences of his life, right? And so he doesn't like them saying, look how good you are at all these things, when he's just like, I wish I never learned that I was good at these things.
Right.
But he's really good at these things, right? He has this like natural gift. You know, he wants to say it was just luck, but Ron and Hermione are just trying to convince him, no, you have something. There is something natural in you. You are just better at this than even Hermione, the best student in the school. Right. And you can teach us some things, and we want to learn from you because you have this gift, right? I wonder what you think about that, and what do you think about Harry's charisma as a wizard?
So I agree with Harry in this argument. I agree with both, right? Like, Ron and Hermione are essentially saying, like, because of what's happened to you, people have their eye on you and therefore would trust you to do this. And also you have experience, right? Like, but them saying that he has a gift, I really find Harry's pushback convincing and important. And especially the moment where Harry says, you are implying that Cedric did something wrong.
Yeah.
In saying that, like, there's something special about me, like, you're saying that there wasn't that special thing about Cedric. And it's sort of like he's doing what I should have done with the Dorothy Austin moment, where it's like, we're all special. Voldemort just decided to not murder me. He could have decided to murder me. And yes, our wand's locked, and yes, all of these other things, but he sees the circumstantial nature of all of it. And, you know, this is something that I feel like famous people, at least the ones who I like, will say of like, yes, I am really successful because I work hard and I'm gifted, but there are other people who work just as hard and are just as gifted. And like, I also just got lucky, and also people were just nice to me. Adam Sandler just gave a speech that I loved. He won the like Kennedy Funny Guy Award. And in it, he was just like, everybody always told me I was funny, right? Like, my family knew I wanted to be funny, and so they laughed at all of my jokes. And then all of these other people laughed at my jokes. And then all these, right? Like, I cared about being funny, and I was constantly working on it. But, like, without all of these other people supporting me and introducing me and doing all these other things, I wouldn't be here. And I do think that this is part of what makes Harry charismatic, is this right-sizedness, that he is competent but not overconfident, right? I just, like, I am utterly compelled by this and deeply moved by the logic that he follows, that he's like, this is disrespectful to Cedric.
I think you're right. I think that Harry's point is inarguable. I think that this thing about Cedric, that you're implying that something, that Cedric did something wrong, and the further corollary implication of, has Cedric doing something wrong, is that it was partly his fault, right? Like, that is the, that's the implication that Harry wants to turn away from, right? On the other hand, Harry was not of age and did better than all these other people. Like, Harry does have some natural aptitude, and people do have natural aptitudes for things that can be cultivated, right? And and so I think what's lacking here is not, I think the issue is that they don't charm him, if that's the right language, right? Not that they should charm him. Obviously, he's feeling bad, but if what they want from Harry is for him to help lead this group, I think what they need to say to him is not, you are the only one that can do this, because that feeds into all the feelings of isolation he's already feeling. Like, I'm the only one, I'm all alone. Which is also what he's been feeling since the beginning of the series, right? Like, The Boy Who Lived, like, everyone looks at me.
The chosen one.
The chosen one, right? What they need to do instead is say, like, only we can do this.
Right.
Because Dumbledore's not talking to us, and Umbridge isn't going to help us. We need to help each other. And Harry, we need you to be part of it, because you have experiences that others of us don't. But we need to do this together. I feel like if they sold him on a together thing, like, let's do this together. We'll do this together. Only as a team can we achieve this. And Harry,
and
you're an essential part of that team.
Right.
And this is your role and team. I think he, to be included in something, to feel like he was part of something bigger and not on his own, I think Harry would 100% go for that and not react the way he does. And indeed, that's the trajectory of the series, right? At the end of the series, this is what emerges, like this whole people rising up together, all the students rising up together, even when they think Harry has been lost. That's where it needs to arrive. You know, the intuition from Ron and Hermione is right, or mostly from Hermione, right? And the need is definitely there. And I can see why they interpret it the way they do, because he does have this kind of preternatural gift. How they need to sell it to him is, let's do this together, be part of our team, right? Because then he would not feel further isolated in the way that he already does, and it's frustrating him so much in this book.
I also wonder if something is going on here about just, like, within the context of war and violence, like, the coin toss of it all is just too stark, because we will see Harry in the next book get selected for leadership on the Quidditch team. And he's just like, yeah, right? Like, he feels the pressure of it, but he loves Quidditch. He's good at Quidditch. He works hard at Quidditch. He's like, yeah, I'm a leader here, right? Like, we're going to have tryouts. And it's not distorted. It's not grotesque. And so he can clearly see his role in it. But I think that in violence, everything feels so upside down. Yeah. And this is just something that I really saw, like, with my grandpa, right? Like, people always wanted to, like, valorize his heroism in surviving the Holocaust. And he was like, it could have just, like, it, there was nothing special about me. Like, yep. It could have gone the other way. It wasn't in my hands. And, like, that urgency to tell people, like, I really understand this, like, deep rejection. Yeah. And I agree. Like, if they had made the argument you're making, like, by virtue of the fact that you have survived, you actually now have information that can be helpful, I think is a different argument than, like, you were special and that's why you survived.
Yeah. I think both things can be true, right? I mean, the survivor's guilt is a real thing, and that and it makes sense, right? And it's because violence is chaotic and random. And the definition, I mean, one of the definitions of violence is that it's something we can't control, right?
Right.
I think one of the truths of this kind of violence is that in some situations, no matter how gifted you are, no matter how much you deserve to survive, you might not, right? Like, that's what Harry knows, having seen Cedric, who was great. He was a champion. Like, he was nearly the best at the school, maybe the best at the school. Like, he knows that Cedric didn't deserve it. And there's no level of giftedness that Cedric could have had whereby he would have deserved it, right?
Right.
But it's also the case that Harry has more aptitude in some ways, right? It's not enough to necessarily save him, but it is enough to help him train them, right? And I think that's you're right. That's where the miscommunication is, right? Like, we don't have complete control. We can't prevent all the bad things that are coming. But that doesn't mean there's nothing we can do to try to, you know, cultivate our gifts and our strengths. And that this is the impasse in their conversation, right?
Right. And, like, with my grandpa, right, like, this is something that I think my grandpa did very well. I have a lot of criticisms of him. But, like, he would say there is nothing special about the fact that I survived and others didn't. But now that I have gone through this, I have a distinct thing to say and offer.
Yeah.
Right. And, like, I think that's where that's the moment that Harry is trying to step into.
Yeah. Vanessa, now it's time for our spiritual reading practice. And this week we are going to be doing Pardes. And so to begin with Pardes, I'm going to choose a sentence from random in this chapter. And I flipped open to the chapter and I've placed my index finger at the top left of page 290. And this is what it says. It's a one-sentence paragraph. Professor Trelawney pulled her shawls tight about her with slightly trembling hands and surveyed the class through her hugely magnifying lenses.
So we haven't done Pardes in a while. And so just as a quick reminder, Pardes is a four-step Jewish reading practice based out of the Middle Ages, sort of codified by Rabbi Moshe de Leon. And it is the closest to mysticism that we do on Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. We are going to dig through the text. Matt is going to lead us, no doubt beautifully, through these four steps. And at the end, we're going to see if we have sort of shaken loose a secret that the text has buried within it that we do not yet see. So, Matt, can you help us get toward this potential secret?
Let's do it. Let's go find the secret, Vanessa. So the first step to finding the secret is the P in Pardes, which is Peshat. And so we're going to be looking for the intended meaning of this line. So basically just like the literal meaning, like what's happening, what's going on. Why are her hands trembling and why is Trelawney pulling her shawls tight about her?
Yeah. So, I mean, right. She has shawls multiple, which is fascinating because this classroom we know is like very hot. Like it's so hot that like Harry passes out, right? Like, and so we're potentially learning something about like a vitamin deficiency within Trelawney that she has the like heat turned up to 90 and is still wearing multiple shawls. But it's also like a kind of armor, right? Like these shawls are also, whether or not they are costume, right? Like they are part of her vibe as like seer. And with Umbridge there, she's wearing more than one and is pulling them tighter around her, like sort of shrinking and trembling, right? She's deeply intimidated by the fact that Umbridge is in her classroom surveying her. And yeah, we see her anew in sort of like a pathetic sort of presentation here.
Yeah. Yeah, Umbridge has kind of shown up and like in her typical fashion has just sort of said, I trust you got my note, right? And it's clearly there with some kind of menacing purpose or something. And Trelawney's nervous. Yeah, I think that's right. So the next step of pardes is remez, which means hint. So we're going to choose a word from the sentence and then see what other places in the text it arises. So what word should we choose?
I mean, hands is right there.
Ooh, hands.
Umbridge is obviously cutting up Harry's hand, and here she is creating a situation in which Trelawney has trembling hands. Harry often has incredibly confident hands, right, on the Quidditch pitch, right? Like he has like nimble fingers. And I know in book seven, when he's walking through the forest, you know, he has nerveless fingers. So, yeah, I know we say like the eyes are the window of the soul, but there is something deeply symbolic about hands. Dumbledore's hand is going to be injured.
Grubbly Plank mentions the hippogriff. And we have to remember that Draco has his hand injured by Buckbeak.
I feel like there are a lot of hand injuries both in the book and in life, right? Like, yep. I am married to someone who always has a Band-Aid on his hand, and it's because he works in a lab where he is, like, doing a lot of things with his hands all the time and, you know, cuts himself. And he also cycles and cuts himself doing that. And he, you know, is a hobbyist sort of carpenter, right? So, like, I do feel like I have cut off the tips of my fingers, you know, they grow back, but right, like Hagrid has burns on his hands when he has the dragon living with him, right? Like,
I mean, our hands are just in stuff. Like if you're getting your hands dirty, like if you're in the world, then we use it a metaphor for being active, right?
Right.
Getting your hands dirty means like you're actually engaged in the activity.
Yeah. Right.
And that means that you're going to, you know, things are going to happen. So the third step of pardes is drosh. Drosh means to seek meaning or seeking meaning. And so what we do on the podcast is we think about what sermon we would preach on this passage. So what sermon would you preach about this sentence?
Can you read it for me one more time, Matt?
I'd love to.
Thank you.
Professor Trelawney pulled her shawls tight about her with slightly trembling hands and surveyed the class through her hugely magnifying lenses.
Yeah, I think I would preach on like taking comfort and armor where you can, right? Like she is in a very scary situation right now, whether or not, you know, whether or not Trelawney is a good teacher and sort of deserves to be there. This is a very intimidating situation and she's not been set up for success. And so she's like wearing both of her shawls. And I think that we think of comfort as crutches or as laziness or little treats to incentivize us as like infantile or childish. And I just think that like life is really hard. And if you can like make yourself feel better by wearing two shawls, like wear two shawls. And I would just talk about sort of being unapologetic about self-soothing in order to do hard things. As long as you're still doing the hard thing that needs to be done in front of you. You know, wear two shawls. What about you, Matt? Kind of a
shame. Yeah, I like that one. I think I would probably preach my sermon more from the perspective of the students than from the perspective of Trelawney, only because we already heard such a wonderful sermon about from the perspective of Trelawney.
Yeah.
Just that Trelawney has been an antagonist to Harry and to Ron for so long. And honestly, she hasn't been great. Like we've talked about how her pedagogy towards Harry especially has been kind of problematic in all her predictions and so forth. But now like there's a larger and deeper and I've used this word already, but it's kind of more menacing threat in the room. And they see her kind of vulnerable and they see her scared. And at least the reader feels some sympathy. I'm not sure Ron and Harry feel sympathy for her yet. Maybe they do. I just think that there's an opportunity here to build alliance, to maybe reconcile across some difference and try to unite in against a greater threat. Something like that. I would get preachy and soapboxy about standing together and standing up to things, probably.
I love that.
All right. So the last step of pardes is the secret, the sod, the thing that has been shaken loose by this conversation, the thing that we did not see in the passage when we read it and that our conversation has shaken loose. What's the secret, Vanessa?
I think the secret to me is that she's actually been quite brave here. Right? Like, I first read her as, like, being pathetic. But she, right, like, the next sentence is, we shall be continuing our study of prophetic dreams today, right? Like, Her hands are shaking. She is pulling these shawls closer, but she's going to keep going. And I think there's a tremendous amount of courage in that. What about you, Matt?
Something about her glasses. I don't know. Her giant magnifying glasses.
And her being a seer.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, right? That's the irony, like the humorous irony of her having giant glasses when she's a seer. The glasses that she uses to see everyone else and she's a seer are hugely magnifying. But as an observer of her, as one of the people in the class watching her with her trembling hands, pulling her shawls tight, like it also allows us to see into her more clearly, like to see her eyes more clearly. There's something about how the magnifying glasses necessarily work in two directions, and that not only do they make her look more vulnerable because she has big eyes like a baby, but she is actually more vulnerable in that moment.
It's beautiful.
Well, thanks for joining me in Pardis.
Thanks for leading it.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This week's voicemail is from Shauna.
Hi, Vanessa, Matt, Casper, Ariana, AJ, and all the lovely people that make this podcast. I'm Shauna from Dublin's chapter, and I've just finished binge listening to all episodes, so I decided to send you a message to commemorate. Would love to make a comment on your last lectio, selected passage from Book 5, Chapter 4, under the theme of apathy. Don't go far inside and don't touch anything. It felt to me like a natural path to apathy. Don't go inside yourself. Don't go deep enough on your feelings and values. Don't touch any traumas. Don't question your assumptions. Isn't that a recipe for apathy? Like in old Egypt, they had a practice called the Rise of the Walking Dead, where the whole idea was that most people live in a walking dead state that I associate with apathy, until they start going far inside, asking questions, thinking, feeling for themselves. And this would be guided by people that were already walking the walk and actually living instead of just surviving. And so for that, I would like to bless Hermione today and all the people like you who incessantly question and trigger in your community the need to go deep and to take things out of place just for the sake of it. I want to thank you for everything, but mainly for the way you remember members of this community who have been loved and lost. I really, really pay close attention. I think it's such an important moment to reflect on our own grief too. So it's so touching to hear how we describe our loved ones. And it shows what's important in the end. Thank you. Thank you also for the new Four Reliances reading practice. I adore it, especially the little reminder to value more the tea than the teapot. Like, take the teaching, not the teacher. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I love your podcast. Bye.
Shauna, I love this idea that you bring, that apathy comes from not looking from within. And I especially love that it gives us a way out of apathy. I feel like when we are in a state of apathy, I've often sort of looked around for inspiration and been like, come on, world, inspire me. pull me from this. And I love that there's something sort of more accessible to me that I can just sort of look from within, look to within, I guess. And just thank you for this beautiful voicemail. It was deeply moving, and we're so glad to sort of have you as a listener and as part of this community. It's a pleasure to be in community with you.
Yeah, thank you, Shauna, for this. You're really kind and generous voice memo, generous to us and, you know, and all you said about this community, and also generous in the gifts you gave us of your interpretation and also in introducing us to this practice of The Walking Dead. I'm really grateful for you and for your voice memo.
It is now time for us to remember members of our community who have been loved and lost. Bob Murawski, who was 61, a Phillies fan, a devoted dad and friend. Charlie, who was 13, who was joy encompassed, hilarious, and a friend to all. Vivian Nebbett, who was 91, an avid puzzler and amazing cook. And Jeffrey Gibson, who was 33, caring, creative, passionate, and had a wonderful laugh. May their memories be a blessing to us all. Yeah, it is now time for us to offer blessings for characters in the chapter. Who would you like to bless?
I'd like to bless Grubbly Plank. Professor Grubbly Plank. You know, I wasn't sure why I wanted to bless Grubbly Plank when I read the chapter, although I listed her name as the professor I wanted to bless. And I think that the course of this conversation, I've learned why. It's the thing you said about competence. That
yeah.
Grubbly Plank is just there to do a job, and the High Inquisitor can be there and ask questions if she wants to, and Grubbly Plank's going to answer them, and not trying to charm anybody, give an honest answer. Think Dumbledore's great. Think Hogwarts is going well. We got some animals here. Can't tell you about Hagrid. It just seems there to do the work at hand and is doing it well.
Yeah.
Blessings.
Right-sized. Yep.
Right-sized. That's right. How about you, Vanessa?
I want to bless Hermione for, I'm sure I blessed Hermione for this moment 5 years ago when we did this chapter. She makes a potion for Harry in order for him to soak his hand when he comes back from detention. Mm. And she's even a little scared to give it to him. Like, this is a risk for her, Harry. She can't predict Harry's responses to extensions that she sees as extensions of care in this book. And she makes it anyway. And it just shows effort and grace and risk. And that's why we love Hermione. So I want to bless her for that. Matt, next week, I will be reading Book 5, Chapter 16, The Hog's Head, through the theme of satisfaction with one Casper Terkyle. Just a few reminders before we give our thanks. We have pilgrimages available. We have some scholarship money available. You can write to us at commonground@notsorryproductions.com or go to notsorryworks.com to learn more. This was a Not Sorry production. We are a feminist production company. Our executive producer is Caitlin Hoffmeister. We are edited and produced by AJ Aramas. Our music is by Ivan Paisau and Nick Bull, and we are distributed by Acast. We want to thank Shauna for your beautiful voicemail. Laura Glass, Ariana Nettleman, Julia Argy, Margaret H. Wilson, Nikki Zoltan, Hannah Rehack, Courtney Brown, Casper Terkyle, Natalie Folkert, Stephanie Paulsell, and everyone who sent in the names of their loved ones.
Oh, I need to
Are
time
you
myself.
Ready?
Hold on a second. No. That time I actually meant it. I didn't have my timer ready. That wasn't the bad joke that I do every time. That time my timer was not ready.
No, I'm annoyed at myself that I like can't learn to ask it a different way.